It should be April Fool's Day, and the joke should be on you. Welcome to the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing. I'm your host, Scott C. It is the first weekend of April, and that means it is the big-ass Writers Conference, the AWP Conference, taking place right now in Los Angeles, California. And you might think that there's not a lot of Sundress Academy for the Arts news, but you would be wrong. Because since AWP is, as I'm recording this, in full swing right now, there's a few SAFTA contests going on. If you stop on over, if you're in the Los Angeles area right now and you attend the book fair and you stop on over at table 1438, that is the table for Sundress Publications, Sundress Academy for the Arts, Best of the Net, and much, much more, there are two contests at least going on. One of them is us, the SAFTAcast Mugshot Contest. Stop by the table, take a picture of yourself with the SAFTAcast coffee mug, and then tweet it to us at SAFTAcast. Send it to us on Facebook at our Facebook page, or send it via email to saftacast@gmail.com for your chance to win one of two amazing prize packs. There is also the Sundress Sun Hunt taking place. They're doing a photo scavenger hunt this weekend. Follow them on Twitter at @sundresspub to see each day's challenges. And use the hashtag sunhunt, that's one word, S-U-N-H-U-N-T, and get chances to win some awesome prizes. And here's the great part of this one. You don't have to be at AWP in LA to play the game. For more details, as I said, follow them on Twitter at @sundresspub. But maybe it's no longer AWP and you're at the convention when you hear this episode. Maybe this is your first time tuning in, whether you heard about us at the convention or from somebody else or from a friend of a friend or perhaps the friend of an enemy or the enemy of a friend or what have you. Regardless, we'd like to say hi to all our new listeners. So, hi, new listeners. Thanks for checking us out. And for our long-term listeners, hi again. How you doing? I say all that because if this is your first time or your 15th time or perhaps 49th time tuning into the program, you have picked a hell of an episode to tune into because this is our second birthday episode. We're a week or two off the mark now. Shh, don't say anything. I won't either. But we're calling this episode 49 our second birthday episode. Once a year, we'd like to bust out the stops and have a birthday episode and celebrate our founding of 2 years ago. And here it is indeed, and we have got the perfect guest for a two-year anniversary. I have often said that there are three people really responsible for the SAFTAcast. There's me, yours truly, the voice of the program. There is T.A. Noonan, who was the guest of our first birthday episode, who has been instrumental in helping the program along. And this year, we welcome the third of those three, Erin Elizabeth Smith, the head of Sundress Academy for the Arts, the founder of Sundress Publications, and much, much more. Erin is truly a delight to have on the program. We're so glad to finally have her here, and now we can get those people off our backs who are saying, when are you going to have Erin Elizabeth Smith on your program? The answer is, in a moment. Let me set this up for you. It's all good, and it is good indeed, because it is a good interview today, folks. Erin is as wonderful as you might imagine her to be, and we learned some fascinating stuff on today's episode. Where Erin got her love of cooking from? What recipe might she never try to cook again? How does she keep it all together, managing Sundress Publications, the Sundress Academy for the Arts, Best of the Net, and so much, much more? And we take some listener questions here on today's program. It is truly a magnificent interview. Happy birthday, SAFTAcast. Here's to more years of talking to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, because as we like to say here at the program, your writing doesn't matter. With that, I welcome you to episode 49, which begins right after our theme song. Hey, there we go.
Turn your volume up a little bit. All right. Yeah. Sorry. I haven't logged into Skype in years and I was like, I don't remember what my fucking password is. So Anyway, all is good.
Well, Aaron, finally we have you on this program.
Yes, I'm excited.
Many people have asked, when are we finally going to get the head of Sundress on here? And I'm like, well, obviously you don't know how busy she is.
Well, that is true. I have about 80 things that I've already done today, but afterwards I'm going to go forage for fiddleheads, and I'm very excited about this.
What the heck is a fiddlehead?
It's a type of fern, and it's like super prehistoric, kind of like, unfurls out, but like it starts out as just kind of almost like a little fuzzy snail when the leaves are new, before they kind of unfurl in this kind of almost leathery thing. And right at the moment where they're kind of fuzzy snailness, you can pick them and then cook them up. I usually just do them in like butter and salt and pepper, and they're really awesome. They just taste like essence of forest.
I was just about to ask, what do you do with them when you find them? But that answers my question there.
Yeah, you can, there was one night, the first time we fiddleheads. We grilled them up because we didn't have electricity at the farm yet, and we were making burgers, and we put them on top of venison burgers, and also very delicious. So,
damn. For the people who have never been to Sundress, you guys eat well.
Yes, this is very true. So...
Aaron, before we get started, though, I want to start it off with a segment we do on the program. The burning question is on everyone's mind, and this is a very important one today, because you are one of the three heads of this show, as I think of it, the three masterminds, and in fact, it was you who inspired the burning question segment. So I am going to ask you a very specific one. It didn't take me more than a second to realize what the burning question is, because this was the first one, and so I throw it at you.
I remember this one.
What is your favorite flavor of Doritos?
Okay, now I have to ask a follow-up question, because that is past or present.
Whatever you want.
Okay, so, because back in the early 2000s, they had one, and it was in a green bag. And I remember, I don't know if like my taste buds just weren't used to heat yet, but they were explodingly hot, but also incredibly addictive. Currently, I'm a big fan of the Doritos Roulette. It's a wonderful bag of party fun where most of them are just the normal cheesy ones, but then one of them is also flamingly hot, and that's always entertaining. But of course, hanging around with the people that we do, everybody's upset when you don't get the flamingly hot one. So
try to determine who among you has the flaming chip.
Yeah, I tried to figure out if I could do it by sight, so I could just kind of like rummage through the bowl and find the ones I wanted, but no can do.
Sneaky devils there. Damn Doritos magnet. Let's back up for a second. The whole cooking thing, we mentioned, you know, people who come to Sundress, come to SAFTA, they eat well. When did you get into the whole cooking thing?
When I was younger, I cooked a lot for my family. But at that point in time, I didn't have a lot of skills, and my mom could make a couple things well, and I learned those things. So I've got like a stuffed meatloaf and a stroganoff, but I really got into like super fancy cooking probably closer to like, I want to say I was in my first or second year in grad school. I was actually back home visiting my grandmother for a couple weeks, and she'd gotten really addicted to watching the Food Network. And so since I was home and I didn't really have much else to do except like hang out, I watched a shit ton of Food Network. Like, I'm talking like probably hundreds and hundreds of hours of Food Network. And of course, I was like, once you see those things, you're like, oh my God, I really need to eat them. And this was back in the time, in the early 2000s, kind of in the very beginning, before Food Network got deeply in its heyday. And so there was actually people who like made interesting things, as opposed to like pour a can of soup into crock pot, pour frozen vegetables into crock pot, certain crock pot on. It was like actually things that were presented beautifully and that required some skill. And so I just started like pulling recipes from the web and just trying out all sorts of new things. I was like, if that sounds good, or alternatively, if it sounded really weird, because I was like, well, if this sounds gross, but why would people eat it if it was gross? So that's how I kind of got into making weird food. And then it just kind of spiraled out of control. So actually just telling somebody the other day, there's probably about like, maybe 10 dishes that I make more than twice a year, or more than twice a year, but most things are for like dinner. Lunch and breakfast are fair game. But really, like most of the time I'm cooking something for the first time. So it might be the only time. I like trying out new things. I like going to the, you know, Asian Mart and digging through like, ooh, what, you know, last time around I bought beef cheek and which I, all these things I've made before, but beef cheek and goat. And I bought a big thing of pork fat, which I did some weird stuff with. And then, yeah, I bought some like blue crabs, and it was just like, you know, all of the stuff that was incredibly cheap, but that is kind of exotic and makes makes your meals more fun.
One of the things I have learned from you is that you don't have to pay top dollar for amazing food.
This is true. I have many skills in terms of the cheap shopping. So number one, Aldi, which is the awesome of all awesomes. And I'm very excited because we get wine in our Aldi starting on July. It's been too long. And yes, Aldi, search out your local Asian marts or Mexican tiendas or any sort of thing where you're going to get a non-standard American fare. And usually you're going to save an enormous amount of money on that. So you know, Trader Joe's is okay, but most of the stuff you can, unless you're going for like cheese or like nice meats, like most of the stuff you can get at Aldi for cheaper. And then, yeah. And then I also do the, what my partner Joe refers to as the green meats at Kroger, which are the going into like the manager special area and trying to like determine like how close to the end of shelf life is this really? And usually all of that's like on the super cheap too. So I very rarely pay full price for anything because I grew up poor and I don't know how to do that. So
it's all in how you cook it.
Yes, exactly.
Couple spices, three ingredients, you got it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you have a good spice rack, you can do anything. I think there's a lovely quote from Firefly even about that. So, but yeah, I mean, just, yeah, a couple different things and you're good to go.
One thing I know about your cooking skills is that you love to throw down food for multiple people. What do you get out of that, really? Because it's a lot of work to throw a food party for people.
I don't know. That's something... I have no motherly instincts towards children, but I have enormous motherly instincts towards adults. Not in a creepy way, I came out kind of creepy. Like children, I can, you know, I could, they can mostly leave, but sometimes take. But I really like taking care of people, and like I like feeding them. I like everybody sitting around a table and enjoying something delicious. I like making people stretch their culinary abilities. So, you know, I know like I have one friend who comes over and who's a vegetarian at all other times except at my house. Or I have people who wouldn't necessarily, you know, try something weird or even try something that's just kind of slightly, you know, something you couldn't get at McDonald's or Applebee's. But, you know, it's rude if you don't try it in somebody's house. So I think I like to really push boundaries with that, and it gives me a little like space to. I know, you know, last year for Joe's birthday, we did an explorers party, which we throw usually once or twice a year, where everybody has to bring something weird that they find, something they usually traditionally never cooked before. But it could be something they've never eaten before. And we all cook it together. And last time we had like muskrat, including like muskrat brains. We had a tarantula. We had cockroach. We had a whole bunch of bugs. Chinese okra, which is now one of my new favorite things. And it gives you an excuse to try stuff. And if you don't like it, you don't like it. But you can always say you've tried it. Like, you know, you can eat one cricket in your life and it can be the grossest thing that you've ever eaten, which crickets are delicious. So I don't know why that would be the case. But you can say that you've ate it for the rest of your life. And so therefore you get to be cool. So for just trying one thing once.
I hung out with you one time and ate beef heart and, pig heart. And to this day, people look at me weird. I'm like, but it was tasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like a lot of times if you just try once and you really open yourself up to it, like most of the stuff is good. If it's prepared well, like I love innards. I mean, kidneys, I've had some kidneys that are a little not great, but I've had some kidneys that are some of the best things I've ever had. But like liver, brain, testicles, all of these things are actually really, really tasty and very traditional foods in a lot of cultures. You know, I think one of the things that I find grotesque about American food culture is the idea like, oh my God, it has a face, I can't eat it, or I don't want to see the animal before it was dead. And I was like, then you don't deserve to eat meat. Like, you have to understand, and you need to be able to be willing, if, you know, people who are like, I'll only eat chicken breast and not on the bone and with no skin. I'm just like, what is wrong with you? Like, how you, if you're going to divorce yourself from the animal that gave up its life that much, you need to rethink your meat eating, I believe, in general.
Besides, chicken thighs would have to have the bone and the skin on it, otherwise it sucks.
I concur. Well, chicken breast. Chicken thighs, you can sometimes pull it off if you're putting it into a stew just because it's dark meat, but yeah, it's so much better on the bone and with the skin on. So it, like, holds an alt flavor, you get crispy skin, and... oh, so good, so good.
Is there any American, like, standard foods that you just detest?
Everything Applebee's. No, I really hate chain food. Like especially sit-down chains like TGI Fridays and Crapplebee's and Ruby Tuesdays. Like, all of those they have no flavor. I mean, you know, like, the heated up meat patties, anytime you go to a restaurant, they won't give you a medium rare or rare anything like that. I just find, I'm like, it's just gross. Like, and I'm trying to think of, like, traditional, like, American food. I don't really like hot dogs that much, but it also depends on, like, what type of toppings on them. So I could see a hot dog that I would like, but I ate a lot of meat in tube form during the first year and a half at the farm when we didn't have electricity. Like, when we were still working on the outside, and so we just grilled everything. And I ate so many fucking hot dogs that it's just, like, I can't go back to them. So
at least store-bought hot dogs.
I feel the same way about pizza. I don't like most pizzas, like a Papa John's or Domino's or whatever that. I can't eat them anymore. Ate it way too much as a kid. Way too much sugar in the tomato sauces. That just feels like it's, I don't know, it just feels like it's from a pantry somewhere and not from anything that, like, actually grew in the earth at any point in time.
I'm not going to argue with a sweet marinara. Sometimes it can be really good, but you're right. I avoid chain pizza at all costs.
I concur, yeah.
That's why I always feel sad when I ask students what their favorite pizza place is, and they're like, Little Caesars. I'm like, I thought like you once.
Oh, well, I mean, they do at least wrap one of their pup pizzas in bacon, which is kind of exciting, so...
Americans, when did we just stop caring?
I know, right? I still, the combined two foods I don't like together, I am honest that I did not eat, which was the pizza that had the little hot dogs in the crust. I really have a soft spot for incredibly crazy gimmicky food items. So, like, that to me, I was like, I hate both of those things, but I want to say that I've eaten it. I think it's partially because people get so freaked out and they determine that it's like the end of America because this thing has happened. And I kind of want to be a part of that. So, yeah.
I recently did that with the Taco Bell, one of their new releases. And I'm like, okay, I can say I've had this. I will never have it again, though.
Ooh, which one did you have? Was it one of the... like, some of those are actually not... they're terrible when you're sober. You should never eat Taco Bell sober, but...
it was that weird combination of, like, soft taco and quesadilla.
Yes. But did it have, like, the like, melted nacho cheese sauce in the middle?
I honestly don't remember at this point. I kind of blocked it out of my memories.
Okay. Now, I did have that one drunk, and... despite the fact that I wore half of it because the nacho cheese exploded all over me, it was exceptionally good after a lot of cheap beer. I will say that.
The booze and I, we don't get along anymore.
I know, I understand. So.
Yes, I have to eat Taco Bell sober. Pity me, world.
No, that is a sad thing. That is a very sad thing. But no hangovers, so bonus on that. And the older I get, the worse those become.
Yeah, there will come. I'm told there will come a day where you start swapping out the 100 proof for ibuprofen and herbal teas.
Oh, no. I don't want tea parties. I want bourbon parties. Yeah.
Well, so far, that's what you've been able to do with Sundress, hold the bourbon party.
This is true. This is true. I'm very excited about that. So, but yes, one day the liver will start to fail me, or at least I will start to fail it, one or the other. So,
question, who will give up first?
Excellent point. So, and I'm not quite sure if I win either way.
I don't think you do. In some ways, I do envy you, though, because I got out of drinking before I had the chance to experiment with the really good stuff. So all my experience was crap.
Oh, yeah, that is hard. Because, yeah, there is good stuff. And it always does come so much later in life. And maybe that's a good thing because, if I had the good stuff early and had access to it, like, it could have been... way worse than it was.
You would have been spoiled for life then, pretty much.
Oh, yeah. No, you can't go back. It's really hard. So
I think you got to start out with, like, cheap beer and work your way up.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the hard things about living in Mississippi is that when I moved from Illinois, they had, like, one of the top 50 bars in the world in Champaign-Urbana, weirdly enough. It was a really great bar. They had just amazing beer. It was really cheap. And I moved to Mississippi, and it's changed now, but at that point in time, it was, the beer had to be low graph. So it had to be, I think it was like 5.9 or lower. And because of that, they only basically had the bigger name brands. So it was kind of like Bud Light, Miller Lite, whatever other crappy things, and then like two decent things that I usually didn't like. So yeah, so I had to go from drinking like, you know, these awesome porters and these kind of, you know, microbrew, blah, 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 to drinking swill. And it was, that was a difficult transition, but I think it saved me a lot of money in the long run.
I could understand that, definitely. So in a way, then you're kind of living the dream. Then you get to have awesome food, awesome company, awesome booze, all in the hills of Tennessee.
That's true. I can't really complain. So I will say, having your dream come true is a lot more work than I thought it was going to. You know, they don't really put those in the Disney movies. Yeah, I was like, all right, you know, my big dream is always to own an artist residency and to be able to like cook meals and, you know, and hang out with good writers and be live in a place that's beautiful and mountains with water and blah, blah, blah. And I have like all of these things. And, you know, at the cost of working 80 hours a week. And it's a good work. And a lot of that work is spent like in a social space. But yeah, but it was surprising that they need to remedy the Disney movies a lot. But that might be a nice way to do it, too.
So it comes with a price then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it comes with a price. But I mean, it's a good price. And it's a price definitely worth willing to pay.
It's the price that you come to bed at night and you're like, oh, I put in a long day today and it feels good.
Yeah, or, you know, or the price is like that bleary-eyed look of like staring at the computer for 6 hours, editing manuscripts and answering emails and tweeting and Facebooking and Instagramming and, you know, answering more emails and all of the, you know, coding a bunch of different websites. I mean, you get that kind of bleary, half-dead feel. That's a common price that I pay. Also, hangovers, that is a common price I pay as well.
How do you do it? Honestly,
there are some, I don't know. That's a difficult question because I don't really know how to answer it. I don't get distracted. If I sit down to do something, like I can get distracted by other things on the computer. So like, you know, if I'm writing, a lot of the stuff's very quick. So, you know, and very automated. So, you know, posting up on Facebook every day, it's like, okay, I'm going to post the wardrobe every day of the week. And then I'm going to post two other things. And we always have something else to post. So tweeting, I just kind of, you know, pull through that. And that's all of that's really easy. But I think a lot of it has to do with being able to delegate. You know, we have an amazing team of people. We have over 60 people who work with us at Sundress and SAFTA. You know, having my, Jane Huffman, who's our staff director, works with all of our amazing interns. And so I'll send out, like, you know, poor Jane, I feel so bad for her. I think sometimes she gets like 12 to 15 emails from me a day that are like, hey, here's like 80 different things to do. And can you find space and get them done? And they always get done and they always get, you know, moved through. So whereas, you know, beforehand, I was answering all these emails and creating all these spreadsheets and sending out all these like different, like, you know, working on the blog. Now we've got an intern and editorial staff that do a lot of that work as well. You know, and then obviously T.A. Noonan, who helps with all of our, you know, helps with our covers and our interiors and helps me with coding and is basically, you know, my other half in the editorial sense. And, you know, we couldn't do everything without her by any stretch. And then Sarah Henning, who's on board as our other associate editor, we basically, because we brought her on, we're able to take two more books every year. So beforehand, we were publishing about four titles a year, plus an anthology. And now we're going to be able to move up to six. And then we also have Jen Hanks, who now took over the reading series, not the reading series, the chapbook series, which is fantastic as well, because they are able to put together the new chapbook anthologies, our chapbook prize, and other solicited chapbooks that we do throughout the year. So being able to delegate, I think, is a huge part, and that's been able to be how we can grow. Before SAFTA, I also ran Best of the Net and Stirring, and once I started doing the residency and then the local work with SAFTA, I realized I just had to delegate. So, you know, Beth Couture spent a year as the managing editor at Best of the Net, and then Darren Demery has taken over for the last 2 years. Lucy Brown and Andrew Cook took over Stirring a couple years ago. So it's been, and that's been great too, because it's had other people at the helm. So it's seen directions stay fresh, and it doesn't feel like it's just a bunch of stuff that I like every month. It can be, you know, it's a lot more, it shows a lot more varietal, and it gives, and that I think is healthy for the folks who get the cool opportunity of working with these awesome journals and anthologies, but also for Sundress as a whole. So
I feel like what I'm talking to you, and you're just, you know, going on about it and like what's coming up in the future. Every time I get the updates from you, I feel like Dick Clark in that famous moment on American Bandstand when he looks at Madonna and says, "What do you want to do?" And she looks at him and says, "Conquer the world."
Was that laughter maniacal enough? I should probably work on that.
I don't know if you can. Yeah, you know, it just wouldn't be you to be maniacal.
Oh, I know. I'll have to, like, I don't know. The ducks are pretty maniacal. I could probably get them to quack some scary, evil scientist laughter at you. But yeah, no, I mean, the problem was, is that over the summers, when I was teaching, I would always get bored. And so I get bored and I'd be like, all right, let's start something new. So, you know, back in 2011, I remember TA and I were talking about putting, this before she was working with us, and I absolutely loved her book and the press that picked it up, it folded. And I really wanted to see it in the world. And we kept talking about it. And then finally, I was like, why don't we just, I'll publish it. So we got that out. And that started the whole print series. We weren't doing print before 2011. And now we publish seven books a year just on the Sundress imprint. Plus we have Flaming Giblet, which TA runs, Agape, which Fox Fraser Foley runs, Sundress Kids, which Leslie Chance runs, and Doubleback Books, which Melanie Jordan runs. So we've got four different imprints that do a wide variety of things, plus the Sundress imprint. You know, one of the things that I like about the ideas of doing imprints is, if somebody has an idea and they can pitch it and they want to do it, I'm happy to do that, especially if it's not going to add more work for like our core staff, if it's something that they want to create their staff to do. I think that's fantastic because I think it builds community between the journals and between the presses and all together as well. So, you know, when we're supporting Sundress, we're supporting all of our, not just all of our imprints, but also, and not our own books, but we're also promoting all of the journals that are under the Sundress title, all of the authors that are under all of the Sundress titles. And we're able to kind of build this network of writers who are respectful and kind and supportive of one another, that read one another's work, that review one another's work. And, you know, I think it's not a matter of kind of building an empire of Aaron, but instead building a literary community that has a space where respect is first and foremost.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's like when I think of Sundress, I know we have our issues and everything. It's like one big family, but how do you keep drama from overtaking?
I have just zero patience for drama. I really, really do. I spent enough of my life kind of embroiled in different things that if I see it's happening, I tend to be somebody who just kind of confronts it directly. I'm not a passive aggressive person. If there's something that's a problem, you know, I think it's important to talk to somebody and make sure that everything is okay. And where is this coming from? You know, just being fucking grownups, man, that is something that we as a community sometimes have a problem doing. And that's, I think, something that I like to be able to do and treat our writers and our fans and our readers and our editors with the same respect that I would hope they treat all of the rest of us.
Maybe it rubs off. I don't know. You know, some people are jerks.
But not as much as ducks.
Ducks are high below Hitler. They're like number two.
They're really, really up there. So, yeah. And for those in the listening audience who are not aware of duck jerkdom, they are rapists. They are necrophiliacs. They have weird, crazy duck penises that fall off and reform every year. Google it. It's disturbing. So that their weird duck penises can go into the weird duck vagina mazes. Anyway, it's totally strange. And they also they're just nasty to one another. We have these three mallards that just kind of strutted around all the time and would just beat up on the other ducks, and to the point where we had to cull one of, well, we had to cull the male duck because he was just being too damn aggressive. And we had to cull the duck that it was beating up on because she, caused her to bleed. And she was just like hovering and stressed and losing weight. And it was not good.
But they do provide good eggs and God bless duck meat.
That is true. And that keeping your own ducks the duck meat, unless you're keeping them in pens and not letting them move around much, is not as good as store meat. I hate to say that because there's just not much fat on them. And part of the joy of duck is the fat and the way that it kind of, renders through. But duck eggs are a thing of wonder and glory. And yeah, cracking one of those into like a bowl of ramen is like just pretty much the best thing ever.
Take store-bought ramen to a whole new level then.
Yes, it does. So I'm a big fan of gussying up store-bought ramen. That's one of my favorites.
So let me backtrack for a moment here. This work ethic, this hyper-focus you have, does this come from like your childhood growing up in South Carolina, or did this develop later on?
Interesting question. I've always been very type A since I was young, and like even as a child, like, so I moved around a lot. Like the first year, I went to a different school in kindergarten, first, second, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh. So like all of my early years, I was constantly moving. And we were just really poor. We kept getting evicted from houses, and we are moving to someplace small, someplace less expensive, or God knows what else. I don't know all of the background stories in terms of that. But every time I moved to a place, I realized I had to make a whole new set of friends. So I had to get good at that. So I started making clubs everywhere I went. So, one place it was like the horse club. I think it was called like Horse Sense or something silly like that. Another group I had was like a jump roping club. And then I had like a riding club. And so like all of these different places, I would start a club and be like, hey, if you like this thing, you should come join my club during recess and we'll do that thing that you like. And so I think that definitely resonates in terms of the way I am now, most definitely. But I do think, I think in terms of being able to juggle lots of different things, I think that became a learned skill in terms of like getting, being able to figure out how long something takes. And I think a lot of it's repetition too. So like, when I was first reading for Stirring back, 17 years ago, reading through submissions, took a lot longer. Soliciting submissions is more difficult. All of the stuff I had to do for the first time. Now, I have a solicitation letter I wrote like 10 years ago and I just kind of update from time to time. So, once you do something one time, it becomes a lot easier the second time. So, doing social media for me, which I'd run for 12 different accounts, is just kind of, I can post 70 things a day on a whole bunch of different places. And it takes me, less than an hour to do that. Because again, it's just a lot of it's repetition, a lot of it's learned behavior, things of that nature. So I think some of it's something that's innate. But I think a lot of it's a matter of having been in this business for 17 years. So, I started Stirring when I was 18 and I'm 35 now. So it's, I think a lot of it has to do with that.
Yeah. You gotta be one of the, what is Stirring? It's like one of the oldest journals still publishing on the net, I think.
It is one of the five oldest journals, as far as I know, publishing on the net. No, I can only think of three that are older. Are two that are older, one that's the same age, literally to the month. And I'm going to give space for that there are two more that I don't remember or don't know about.
What are those three that you can name?
Brevity and Courtland Review are older. And Juked started literally the same month, October 1999. So, yeah.
What do you credit to the longevity?
I almost dropped Stirring in the early 2000s. I was in undergrad and I was just crazy busy applying to grad schools and working on a manuscript and finishing up my undergraduate thesis. And I just had so much on my plate and it was taking up more time than I felt like I had. But I also felt like, if I could just push through this, if I give up now, I'll give it up for good. And as soon as I get through all of this craziness, like I'll have time again. And sure enough, I did. And I thought about it again, kind of in the craziness at the end of my thesis time in my MFA program. But again, I was like, if I just get through this, it'll be okay. And so I think a lot of it's just kind of stick-to-itiveness. I think there's a essence of like sometimes when you're super stressed out and super hard to just say, you know what, fuck it. Like this is done. This is just done, period. But sometimes it's like, okay, if I just spend like the 10 hours this month that I need to get this issue out for like 3 more months. It's 30 hours over 3 months. It doesn't have to disappear forever. And I think, you know, watching internet publishing, which, you know, I'm a big, big proponent of, watching so many journals, like where I had pieces published or journals I really respected, disappear. And that's true in the print world, too. But watching them disappear and watching that, and knowing there's nothing that's left behind, like, you know, once a thing is gone, it is gone. That bothered me. And I was like, I don't want to see this. And eventually when I realized I just didn't have the time to do it anymore, I spent a good 6 months leading up to it, kind of working with and talking about and training the editors that are on board now, so that there was some continuity, you know, as well as infusion of youth for the journal as well. Yeah, so that was kind of like, you know, letting my baby go. But, you know, my baby was almost an adult unto itself at that point in time, so.
Old enough to drive a car now, so it's fine. It just doesn't come to you begging for money, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure she will, so.
Eventually. Children. It's a credit to sheer force of will, it sounds like, basically.
Yeah, to some extent. So, but yeah, I think that's an important part. If you feel like the journal has made its run and done its thing, that's cool. Totally, you know, you can let them go. But I don't see stirring that way. You know, I see it as something that can keep living on in different incarnations for as long as it wants to.
Sounds very much like something like the Muppets or something. When one of the heads retires or passes away, it will still continue on its own.
Exactly. So that's my hope, at least.
Do you have to vet people to, like, take over something?
Yeah. I mean, not vet, like, you know, I'm not like the army vets. I'm not like having somebody in a dark car show up and like ask their mother questions about their childhood. But I give things to people who I trust a lot and who I've worked with for a long time. So, you know, you don't, you know, leave your child with, like, you know, a stranger at the mall, you know, same sort of deal. So I don't know about vet, but I think depending on how you utilize that word, I think it's people that I've worked with, people I've respected, people I've known their writing, known their work, known their work ethic and whatnot.
It's more of like surrounding yourself with the right people.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally makes sense because, you know, I'm sure there have been bad eggs in Sundress or whatever have come and gone, but you know what? I'm proud to be part of this group, and I'm saying, you know, full disclosure, yes, you are technically my boss on this program.
Yeah, I'm concerned about that, but yes.
Technically, but, you know, just technically. I feel like there needs to be a flow chart of this, like a family tree of, like, at the top is, you know, Sundress, and then all the different branches and all the people connected everywhere.
Yeah, that would be legitimate. I mean, we do have a lot of arms. So, I know, for a while, I actually realized that when I would get interviewed for stuff, I realized I was just confusing people because I was trying to talk about Sundress as a press, Sundress as a arts community, and Sundress as a residency. And, like, if you start, like, talking about all of those different things at once, it is. It's really difficult to kind of think about, like, it's such a multi-headed beast. So, with so many different moving parts all at once.
Yeah, 4 different imprints, a residency, an entire arts academy with, you know, then the reading series. There's one mm-hmm. podcast, one vodcast, mm-hmm. multiple features on the blog recurring. Mm-hmm. At best of the net, I mean, it's like
chapbook series
as well. Let's not forget that in the e-chaps. I mean, it's just, my God, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot, but I don't mind that. Like, you know, I think people sometimes don't realize, like, the extent of our little mini indie lit empire. And it's not like, you know, we do one thing well and then we try a bunch of other things. Like, I think that's important. You know, when we have leadership for a branch, it's leadership. Like, it's somebody who is, you know, who is doing the work, who is really, like, self-contained for the work that they do. So it's not like I've got, you know, a finger in everything that we do. Like, it's, you know, when Darren Demery puts together a cookbook, which is our vodcast, you know, I don't vet the people on it. I don't, you know, like, test out their, you know, do my America's Test Kitchen of their recipes. It's like, no, I trust you to do the things. So, and I think, you know, again, surrounding yourself with good people is a really important part of that.
And that's one of the things I've always said about this show that I'm thankful for, is that you basically were like, sounds good, go for it. And I put in my mission statement for this aftercast, don't bother Aaron unless I have to.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's the way I should go. Like, you know, it's a community. It's not a oligarchy. So, you know, I think that's good.
I agree. I think it works. And, you know, I'm hoping for many more years with Sundress here and in its many, many forms, you know, as long as we don't do something stupid, like tease the donkey or something, you know?
Oh yeah. He does not like that. So no. Yes. But he did like the fact that I weeded before I sat down to record the show today, and I brought them like 10 pounds of weeds that had grown up over the last week, and they were very excited about that. So
I got to ask now, for our listeners who've never been to Sundress, why do you have a donkey?
We have a donkey because donkeys work as guard animals. They kind of work like sheepdogs, so he'll herd all of our sheep, and we have so many sheep right now. We've got like 11 sheep right now, and then one more still pregnant, so probably one or two more that are coming. So if they need to go up the hill to go eat, they'll all follow Jane, who's our donkey. And then, you know, but also alternatively, if they're a dog or a coyote or something that's trying to cause violence to our herd, Jane as a donkey will, I've seen him like flare up, like ears back and like brays, and all the sheep get behind him, and he just, you know, like puffs up and gets all angry. But donkeys are known to kill coyotes. Like, there's some really, if you Google it on the internet, there's some like crazy pictures and videos of donkeys just like shaking coyotes, like picking them up in their teeth and shaking them to death. So he works as our guard dog, basically. I mean, he's like a big, silly, moody, wonderful guard dog who, like, sometimes, you know, gets very grumpy, and other times is incredibly lovey and snuggly and doesn't realize how much he weighs and wants to put his head on your shoulder and like rest it there. And no, he's really wonderful. And he keeps, you know, again, keeps our animals safe. So if something's awry, you can usually tell by the sound in like Jane's bray.
Yeah, donkey versus coyote, not a fair fight.
No, it's really not. So, yes.
Donkey will kick the shit out of one.
It is very true. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I've seen them raise up against, you know, bigger dogs. I've seen them raise up against like little tiny dogs too, which is really hilarious. But yeah.
I can only picture that as like one of them, you know, like a chihuahua type thing, or something. And Jane just looking down like, no.
Yes. Don't even. Yeah, pretty much.
When it comes to this, like, Sundress, you know, Safta is only about 5 years old now, let's say. Maybe a little less.
About four. Yeah.
So back in 2011 or so, could you have even conceived of what it would be like now?
No. Well, yes and no. I was a little bit more ambitious, but that was okay. My ambition is still there for it. It's just, I think, timing. I didn't quite understand as much as I need to, both in terms of like the time it would take to raise the money as well as the time it would take to do what we need to do. So when we were first looking at the property before we even bought, we realized like how much work was going to go into the house, because I mean, it had been gutted. Well, we had to gut it even more so, but it had, like, all the wiring had been removed and all the plumbing had been removed, and there were like snakes living in the house, and it had been open to the elements with like the windows open and a hole in the ceiling, and like the back door was just hung open, and so it was a mess. So so we had to, you know, gut the whole thing, run the wire, run the plumbing, do all the, you know, there were these big holes in the walls, so we had to re-drywall, paint, and then, you know, run, you know, we didn't have indoor heating and air for a long time, so we had to get that installed. You know, there's just like all these things that just had to keep being made and built. And we still have lots of projects that we want to do. So, you know, sometime this spring, we're actually going to we have a wardrobe in the small short-term writer's residency room. And so we're going to turn the closet in that room, which is just basically wasted space right now, into a little book nook, a little reading nook. So we're going to put like shelves and a little place to, like, little comfy place to sit. And then put a bunch of books in there. So that's, you know, a project that's not like, you know, a pressing project, but something that's going to be fun to do when we get the chance. But again, it's going to be, you know, it'll cost about $70 and it'll take the day and we'll have to paint it and all of that stuff. So we're kind of waiting for a transitional time to do that. But that sort of thing is something that, you know, it makes all the little things you add and like make the space cooler and more, you know, quirky. So yeah, so I think, I think I didn't realize like the how many volunteer hours we need. I mean, we literally have had tens of thousands of volunteer hours. So whether that's like clearing land or building bookcases or drywalling or painting or demolition or putting up fence, I mean, there's just so much stuff that constantly has to be done. And there's so much stuff that we still need to do. So, you know, we have a new acreage that needs to be fenced, and that's, you know, that's going to be a bear of a job. We want to build tiny houses so that we can expand our residency, but that's going to, you know, that means running electricity to a centralized location before we can even think about building the houses. So, because we'll need to be able to run that in, trying to decide, you know, just tons of different things in terms of like, are we going to have running water in these rooms, or is it just going to be a dry cabin? Where are we going to put them? Are we going to cluster them? Are we going to spread them out? Are we going to have like a centralized shower facility? Or are we just going to utilize the main house? There's all these other questions because each one is, you know, it's a pricey undertaking. So it's constant kind of back and forth about like, are you going to spend the money on building another tiny house? Or are you going to spend the money on running water to something or whatever? So there's a lot of things to consider and a lot more things than you would think, because, you know, you're like, okay, you build a little house. It's like, all right, easy enough. So you put up a wall and you put in a bed and there's a roof. Probably that's probably a good idea. But then it's like, how do you make it function? How do you make it wheelchair accessible? How do you make it, you know, what color do you paint it? What kind of like, you know, how far away does it need to be from the other space so that it's still quiet enough? Like, do you have a musician that's coming in? Do you need to soundproof it? So there's a lot of different kind of elements to consider that I had no sense of considering now. And so anytime I'm thinking about any, you know, any new project, it's a constant running in my head of like this sorts of things. So like putting up the barn, it was like, okay, cool, we're going to build a barn. Okay, so now we have to figure out what kind of wood we're going to use. Like, are we going to, how much, what percentage of it are we going to use as a hayloft? What percentage of it we're going to use for a space for the animals for when it's raining? How much floor space do we need? Do we want to run electricity? You know, all of these different elements that, you know, become extra line items when you're building on stuff, but also, you know, become an important part of how you see that space. So one of the things that we really wanted to do with the new barn, for example, was to be able to use it for a reading space. We plan on, and hopefully by the end of the spring, to be able to have a big barn raising party after it's already been raised, and, you know, do a reading, you know, put up all of the poems that people sent to us as a fundraising thing that we did over the winter, to, you know, to do a big cookout and that sort of thing. So make sure, you know, kind of making sure that, you know, each of these spaces is also communal in a different way and can be used in a multitude of ways.
So on one hand, you conceived of the ideas, the concept, but you could not have conceived of all the little things and the actual, like, you can picture, like, okay, there will be a house. Mm-hmm. You have no idea what it will be in the end.
Exactly. And like, yeah, it's like, okay, tiny houses. Everybody's like on the internet, it's like, tiny houses. I like tiny houses. And I'm like, me too. I also like tiny houses because I like being outdoors. I like being in this space. It's so pretty. But there's so much that goes into something that's even just, you know, 80 or 100 square feet. So many decisions that have to be made and so much infrastructure that has to be done before you can even start on the tiny house itself, which we could probably build for about $5,000, just the house. But the infrastructure and everything that goes along with it becomes like, yeah, it's things that you don't think about. It's like, okay, well, where do we run electricity to? How do we do that? If we run water, are we pulling it from the local thing or are we going to dig a well? Like, there's all sorts of other elements to it that is just a whole nother level of complications.
I'm surprised that your mind is still intact.
Yeah, you and me both.
Because I'm like, I'm picturing myself, it's just like, my brain is just wired for like, okay, let's sit down and drink coffee and watch TV for 5 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like doing that too. I don't get to do that enough anymore. That's one of the things I've had to cut out, unfortunately. So I haven't gotten to, I mean, I still do watch plenty of TV, but I don't go out as much. I don't get to see, one of the big things I realized is like, I don't get to see people like one-on-one as much. Like, so much of my time, I'm like, okay, I'm incredibly busy. So if you're going to come see me, I'm going to have this party and you should come. And that being said, I throw a party almost every weekend. So I get get to see people pretty regularly. But if it's somebody like, oh, we should go get coffee or we should go have a beer, it's always like, okay, well, if I'm going to go out with you, I should probably try to see 7 other people while I do it. So it becomes a lot of like, my social life has become very large group oriented social life, usually where I'm also like trying to do work at the same time.
You have to sacrifice some things in order to achieve the dream. And that's like coming back to the idea of Disney. They never mentioned the sacrifices involved.
Mm-hmm. No.
Lousy Disney. It's interesting we're bringing this up and everything because I think this is a good segue then. You know, sometimes on the program, I have listener questions. And I've got a few for you that people wanted to know about.
Yay.
So they kind of touch on some of the topics we've discussed, but let's get into them right now. First listener question from our actual listener here. Is there a food, I'm guessing what they mean by this is there a food or recipe that you will never make again?
Oh, that's a good one.
Like, I don't know, maybe something that just failed spectacular. Like, oh, hell no, never again.
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I have 2 times in a row now fucked up cassoulets, which it's because I don't read the recipe all the way through. I'm like, good enough. Just chuck it all in there.
What is a cassoulet?
Okay, a cassoulet is a French dish that has like beans and a bunch of vegetables. And it's like a kind of a really deep stew. And the problem is with that dish is that it reminds me of a lot of other stews that I do. But this one is, there's a very specific order that you need to do something because it's fucking French and French is always that way. I'm always like, just throw it all in the crock pot and go, boom. And this one is like, you do this for 2 hours and then you do this for 30 minutes and you do this for this amount of time. And it's like an all day kind of thing. And so those I have a lot harder time doing because I'm like, oh crap, I was supposed to take that out 3 hours ago. Or, oh, I get halfway through cooking it. And I'm like, crap, I've got to go run this errand. I like them. I wouldn't say I would not make them again, but I'm trying, but they're difficult. Food I would not eat. That is a harder question. I don't like dried fruit. So I guess kind of one of the things I would say are like fruit cakes. I don't like those. I also don't really like chocolate. And I know that probably elicits some gasps out in the listening audience. Or there's those like, you know, other 1% of the people in the world who are with me on that one. So I don't really make sweets. I used to make a lot of sweets in grad school, but I didn't like sweet things. So then I would have all of these cookies and cakes and whatnot in my house. And I'm like, well, I'm not going to eat these. So I take them for workshop every week. So I guess kind of like I don't bake. I used to bake a lot. I don't really bake at all anymore. It's not that I can't. I just don't enjoy it. So I don't know. Did that answer the question, you think?
I feel like it does. Yeah. Yeah. So another listener question for you. What should I binge watch on spring break?
Ooh, so many things. I'm currently binge watching Deadwood, and I have never watched Deadwood. Have you seen Deadwood?
No, I have not, actually.
Okay. It is really, really good. And I stayed away from it for a really long time because I'd kind of assumed that there weren't really female characters that were important in it because it was really kind of defined by its male characters. And I have found in watching that is the exact opposite, that the female characters are far more as a whole engaging than the men in the story. And I think if somebody's been trying to stay away from that for that reason, you should watch it. It's wonderfully it's like deeply, deeply Shakespearean, like with fucking soliloquies and stuff, except like soliloquies that say like cocksucker a bunch over and over again in them. I'm trying to think, I love The Good Wife. I think it is a brilliant show that gets the credit that it deserves, but a lot of people assume that it's like a Law and Order or one of those other like lawyery shows. And it does have some of that, but the political intrigue in it is really, really fascinating. And the character development and the women in it are just really, really wonderful. So it does a lot with gender and race and economic politics in a way that I think a lot of other those kind of like, you know, case of the week court shows don't do. So, yeah.
I might have put Deadwood on my summer watching list this year.
I think you really should. It's extremely literary and so much cursing, which makes me happy.
It would do it over spring break, except that there's a lot. Like House of Cards season 4 dropped at the beginning of March.
Yep.
Then Daredevil season 2 drops. Then like 2 weeks after that comes House of Thrones, Game of Cards 6. And so it's like there's too much. And then there's, of course, other movies coming out, like Pee-wee's new movie and other ones coming out. So it's like I'm going to have to hold off till summer. That's my main summer TV time.
That sounds good. Yeah, I'm with you on that. I haven't caught up. I would also say anybody who hasn't binge watched Jessica Jones yet, you're really fucking missing out because that show is amazing. But yeah, I do. I'm looking forward to all of those ones that you mentioned. So House of Cards haven't started in yet. Daredevil, not yet. And super stoked about Game of Thrones. They're super angry because I'm one of those people who read the books and now I can't be all smug about shit anymore. And that's upsetting. So
hey, if the rumors are true and the Hound comes back, I'll be happy.
Oh, yes. So the Gravedigger's theory is correct, then. Is that the...
Possibly, because some guy is coming on and he said in an interview something like, yeah, I play a man who was once a very vicious warrior and now is a man of peace. But speaking of television, then another listener question. I thought this was interesting, so I got to ask it. If you could cast Oscar Wilde in any TV reality show, which one would it be?
The Bachelor, obviously. Like, I mean, him and a bunch of screaming women, he'd win every time. It'd be amazing.
Okay, question about SAFTA. Why doesn't SAFTA have any pigs?
Ah, excellent question. We did try to get pigs. So when we were doing the Biscuit Fest last year, we were going to actually buy some pigs. And we got a good deal on like a mama, papa, and baby pig for like $50, which is a really good deal for pigs. And we were going to off the papa, keep the mama and son, and then there would be more pig later. But when we went to go pick, so we get all of our animals off Craigslist. This is also a weird thing. So we see lots of strange farms and pigs are wily. And I learned that they're extra wily in that the night before, the father, a pig, which had been there apparently forever, ran away. And they were like, well, we'll call it. I was like, okay, well, that's kind of why we wanted them. And they were like, okay, all right then. So we did not end up getting pigs. And we've talked about it because we have a pond in the back. And actually, apparently one of the old school methods of getting your pond to not leak. Some of the ponds, especially up here, we have what's called karst, and it's a type of stone that creates like kind of porousness, and so water will leak through more so than it might in like clay or like really trodden soil. So one of the old school methods in terms of how you make your pond so that it stays in the bottom is to get a bunch of pigs, and then they walk across the bottom for like a couple months. They trample all of the mud down and actually fills in all the cracks and basically seals the bottom of your pond. So if our pond does not stay this summer, it's been really good this spring, but if it dries up this summer and it looks like we're going to need to kind of trample it, we will be having pigs. And then after they do all of their fine work trampling down our pond, then we will have barbecue.
Totally understand that, yeah.
Yes.
We got a couple more here. Why did you name it Stirring?
Oh, I didn't think... Okay, so I'll start with why I didn't name it Stirring. A lot of people think of Stirring like, oh, that poem stirs me inside. Like there's, you know, there's this feeling. But I was thinking more like Stirring like with a spoon over a stove or like in a bowl or something. Like I was thinking of that kind of stirring. And I just really liked that kind of notion of like, you know, that the action of unsettling. But then I didn't really start to think about all of the other ways that stirring is used until afterwards. I mean, keep in mind I was 18. So I probably would have thought a little bit more about it later, but I just kind of, I liked the idea of this thing of like this thing that you're unsettling, but also mixing at the same time. And that, like that kind of action I really dug. But then of course it was like, you know, nothing was stirring, not even a mouse. And, then it was, you know, this idea of this kind of like stirring and, poem and whatever. And I was like, oh, damn it. I hate things that mean multiple stuff when I'm trying to just mean one thing. So like the worst is when I get people who send email to Stirring and call it Stirrings with an S. It's like, I'm like, that's not the title of the journal. Or when people call us Sundress Press, I'm like, no, rhyming bad. That's like a total pet peeve. But yeah, so that was the original story. But there's also been some regret in the title later. So
I think it fits now with cookbook and a few other things. I think it ties in nicely, motif.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. It's just I wish it had been a little bit more explicit, like sundress. I mean, sundress is sundress. Like, it's not like it secretly is code for something else. Though I did realize later that it is only one letter away from undress. So, when we were sundress.net, I learned that the hard way one time by typing too quickly. So, yeah.
That'd be a Google activity for me later, I guess.
Yeah, I don't want to know. I'm good.
I'll take the hit for you and find out what it looks like these days.
Yeah, no, it's always been. If anybody wants to put up our porn imprint, Undress Publications.
Well, there you go. If we do an erotica wing.
Yeah, exactly.
There we go.
Yeah.
We got it. Undress Publications. You know. Boom. One last one for you. Big question here. Do you own any pants?
Yes, sort of. I notoriously do not wear pants. I haven't worn pants when I'm not working or pajama pants in over five years. And I just don't like them. But I do wear pajama pants, and I do wear pants when I'm working, sometimes when I'm working at the farm. So I have a pair of purple insulated overalls that I love. I have like two pairs of work pants that I've had forever that I use just so I'm not like, you know, totally and utterly scratched to death when I'm working like, you know, out in the brush. But even like, you know, when I'm over here over the summer doing cleaning and whatnot, I have like my cleaning dresses. So, which is kind of funny. So I don't like pants. They're restrictive. Like, you know, you have to like match things with them. Then there's gotta be shirts and you have to buy two things. So, I mean, right now I can just go to Goodwill and buy an entire outfit for $6, which is like buy one dress, boom, outfit. So that's, yeah. The answer is technically yes, but only for specific circumstances.
Fair enough. I understand. It's personal preference. Me, I just feel weird if I'm not wearing jeans. It's just who I am.
I actually do not own any jeans. So that is one thing I do not own.
Well, fair enough on that. to each their own when it comes to clothing. I knew this hour was going to go fast with the two of us.
Yes.
We have a bit of history together, you know, so I knew that this one was going to go fast. So before we go, though, I got to ask, what you got coming down in the pike right now? I know that you've been shopping around a manuscript, mm-hmm. but what's coming up for us here?
Yeah, I've got my manuscript's out in the world. It's been runner-up twice now, so I'm hoping that means that it's knocking at the door. I will be reading in Dallas the last week of April, and I will be reading in Pittsburgh, I believe, the 12th of July. I will obviously be at AWP.
Which for our listeners is happening right now.
Yes. So come say hi to me at the Sundress table.
There you go.
I'm basically just kind of working right now. We're putting together our residencies for the summer. We're accepting applications for fall residencies where we're pairing with Vita for two scholarships, 100%, 150% for fall residencies, which run September through December. And we're just working on trying to get, you know, keep our head above water before the end of the semester where things calm down for a little bit.
For a little bit, and then the craziness begins all over again as the summer drops. Where can the folks find you online? I know you're quite visible, but where can the folks find you?
Well, of course, you can find us at sundresspublications.com or on Twitter at sundresspub. You can find me personally at sundresspublications.com/Aaron and see some of my selected works and whatnot. But I am eminently Googleable, though I am not the mezzo-soprano who sings opera, nor am I the Aaron Smith of the Aaron Smith Band. So also important to note.
And you do have a Wikipedia page, though.
I do. Thank you, Nick McRae.
Aaron, it is always, you know, it's a pleasure to talk with you. I don't even need to say that, because it's always a pleasure to chat with you, no matter what the circumstances.
Likewise. It is a pleasure being your anniversary guest. So.
Oh, indeed. You know, I'd love to have a dual episode of you and TA, but it just didn't work out yet. But
yes, there's always next year.
There's always next year. We can have a, you know, hoedown little party together on the radio.
Yeah, and then the world can know that TA and I are actually just one brain with two bodies.
I don't doubt that. You two are very close. I can vouch for this. I won't say how, but I can vouch. Enough about that. Anyway, Aaron, it has been a pleasure to have you on here. Enjoy the rest of AWP, and I can't wait to see you guys soon and be back up in Knoxville with you guys soon enough.
We look forward to having you.
Excellent. And for our listeners, stop on by.
All right. Take care.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.